Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural, and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Thanks for coming along tonight. Gordon Parker makes a welcome return to the Sydney Institute. He was here a few years ago talking about a book published by the Black Dog Institute. I'll introduce him briefly. Professor Gordon Parker AO was the inaugural executive director of the Black Dog Institute. He's currently a professor of psychiatry at the University of New South Wales and was previously director of the Division of Psychiatry at the Prince of Wales Prince Henry Hospitals. He's held numerous responsibilities for the Royal Australian and New Zealand College of Psychiatrists, including being editor of the journal and chair of its Quality Assurance Committee. He's a respected clinician and active researcher with a strong international profile who's frequently cited. He's also worked as a creative writer, writing for the Mavis Bramson Show, as a cartoonist for The Oz, and the Bulletin magazine, as a book reviewer for major newspapers, and he even writes fiction. He's also a psychiatrist. So it helps out. So we brought him along tonight in case there are any problems in the room, in this fill-up room, and to talk on the occasion of the recent publication now in the second edition of Professor Gordon Parker's A Piece of My Mind, A Psychiatrist on the Couch. And the topic for tonight is A Psychiatrist on the Couch, Views from the Other Side. Gordon Parker, you're very welcome. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Jared, and thank you, Anne, and thank you, members of the audience, for coming. This opportunity to talk about autobiography and memoir is a wonderful exercise in self-indulgence that an only child like myself can appreciate. The quote, I think, says that I appreciate that you won't all be able to see the PowerPoint. I will talk through the slides. So, Anne, if we could have the next one, and I'm going to move fairly quickly. What I tried to do in this book was to look at what brought me into psychiatry. So there's about sort of 80, 100 pages, supposedly whimsical, what I thought I might have brought into psychiatry. And then I'd really like to focus on the attractions of being a psychiatrist, because I do see it as a very exciting, innovative field. So, next one, thanks, Anne. And so here is the focus. Next one, thanks. And you can't read that, but I can, and that's what matters. So the issue is, what brought me into psychiatry, and the importance of this issue was that looking forward, there's no way in which I could have predicted where I was going to go in my life. Looking back, it seems bleeding obvious. And I thought to myself, I'm sure that's not an unusual story. So what can I try to identify? So I hope there are some general messages that I will come to at the end of my talk. Because I think that there is some relevance for our kids and our grandchildren. Now, basically, as I look back, it was not logical at the time. And I would suggest that we develop as human beings, as children, particularly in adolescence, rather like a plant develops. You send out, you know, arborizing trunks, and then some become established and they firm roots, and others wither and so on and so forth. At the age of 30, I gave up believing in the principle of serendipity. I really do believe that We progressively experiment, and then something we get to a fork in the road, and it's not entirely chance that dictates it. And I will try to articulate that. So really, our career only becomes obvious in retrospect. And Christopher Hinchin said, "The stages by which one mutates or pupates from one identity to another are not always evident when they're being undergone." And Kierkegaard, we always like quoting Kierkegaard, "One is condemned to live life forward and review it backwards." The other aspect that I think contributed to this was that my brain is not linear weighted. So I was rather poor at school, and that was an advantage to going on to a career in medicine. And I was particularly poor at medical school in handling sciences. The Krebs cycle did my brain in. And it took me a long time. It was really only sitting down writing the autobiography that I appreciated the differences between having a left brain waiting and a right brain waiting. Basically, people who are left brain weighted tend to be good at the sciences, and they have an explicit memory. They remember facts. My brain was more weighted towards implicit memory, intuition, and trying to pick up themes. And I will come to that later when I talk about pattern analysis. And it was only, again, in writing this book that I realised that how my implicit brain actually worked for me at a relatively young age. We had a medical student convention and we'd partied hard and I drank too much alcohol and I woke on a beach the next morning. And about 6 o'clock I got up and looked out and about 400 metres away I saw a figure walking along the edge of the water. 400 metres, I'm sure. And I saw this woman, and the image that came in my brain was Undine, U-N-D-I-N-E. And I'm sure that I had never heard that word before in my life, but that image came in. And it turned out, a fellow medical student who I'd known, but in fact that was the start of our relationship, and alcohol, I don't think, had really too much to do with it. But as life has gone on, I have really appreciated that my wife was a wonderful, pacific, lovely, supportive person, and so the concept of Undine, being one with nature, was something that had hit me. I don't think those things are unusual if your brain functions with implicit memory. Of course, it takes you down strange pathways at times, but it can be an advantage in certain fields. But the point was that I was not particularly weighted or blessed with the attributes to do medicine, and then when I became a surgical registrar and I realised I was technically incompetent. That made for some difficulties. And one of my big dilemmas in adolescence was where will I go with my career? And I had a family weighted with doctors, so I was not sure whether I should follow. If I did, was sort of doing what your parents wanted you to do. I wasn't Jewish, but you don't have to be Jewish or mother to be a Jewish mother, as Dan Greenberg said. So the concept of whether I would live my life for the vicarious gratification of a family that was weighted to medicine was a dilemma. And next slide, please. And it was resolved by one Boxing Day when I broke my neck and I ended up in North Shore Hospital under the care of the wonderful neurosurgeon John Grant. And that was a lucky break because I did see some wonderful medical role models, John Grant, Doug Tracy, and numerous others. And I actually saw people who had what I regarded immediately and ever since as the highest value system. And so then that was it. I was into medicine. Next one, thanks. So as I mentioned, I went off to the University of Sydney and I had great difficulty rote learning. I had the Krebs cycle up and I memorised it. And even when I wrote this book and I talked about it, it was all about metabolism of glucose. The editor got back to me and said, you made 3 mistakes. So even after all these decades, I still don't know anything about it. But while I was studying away earnestly, having to rote learn everything, I realised that around me, the University of Sydney was humming with a lot of luminaries who even were luminaries then, and you would remember many of their names, but they were myth-makers and they were beating to drums of exhibitionism, myth-making and promotion and self-promotion. So that music was going on around me and the sirens were dancing, and so I had this boring daytime rote learning and I'm thinking, well, how can I expand myself? So looking back, and again, retrospectively, the 3 things that I might have had going for me was that I was fairly open-minded. The Woody Allen quote, 90% of life is just turning up. So that was one of the trifecta. The second, I enjoyed observing people and trying to work out what made them tick. And that wonderful book by Hal Porter, The Watcher on the Cast Iron Balcony, resonated with me very much. In fact, I lost a job in psychiatry and I said I thought I was basically a voyeur at heart. And thirdly, I had a creative streak that was seeking expression. So, next one. I decided that, as is the wont of an only child, that I would be a fiction writer. So I just sat down and wrote a book of fiction. Typewriter took me six weeks and handed it off to the publisher, who said it would be difficult to publish as I didn't have a track record. And that was just a challenge, so I'd go out and get a track record. So, as Gerard said, I took on a job at the ABC and Science Show in Sydney and later in London. I would write the Diary of a Doctor column for the Sun Herald, you know, which was supposedly about a Macquarie Street Henri, but in fact it was a junior medical student. became a cartoonist for the Bulletin and Oz, book reviewer for the Sydney Morning Herald in Australia for 10 years, and the Mavis Bramson Show, thanks. And here you can see radical young Gordon, you know, you can see reacting against all the forces of conservatism here at a 1964 party with the wonderful Gordon Chater, who was actually not only a superb man, but was a very good mentor to me, because he'd been a medical student at Cambridge and dropped out. And so we exchanged vignettes about whether to stay in medicine or not. And that was a very heady time, and I wrote for the New South Wales version of Mavis Bramson in 64. And then when Mavis Bramson went national, I actually had the great pleasure of writing the opening skit for the national Mavis Bramson, next one. And eventually I took the book back. Now I had a track record, got it published by Lloyd O'Neill, and it was one of six books published in Australia in 1966. Now, was I merely doing it for narcissistic reasons? I don't think so, and I hope not, because I actually wrote it under an alias. And my co-cartoonist, lovely friend at the time called Deborah Williams, similar track story to me in when you look at her career. She sort of fled Australia to take part in the first Basil McKenzie film and is now Lady Macmillan, having married the director of the Royal Covent Garden. So that was my sort of attempt to be creative. And one of the points I'd make is that when I went into psychiatry, next one, thanks Anne, all my creative juices were taken up by psychiatry. Here's a quote by Ronnie Lang. He said when he looked at psychiatry, it looked the same as the rest of medicine, but it was different. And Lang felt puzzled and uneasy. Hardly any of my psychiatric colleagues seemed puzzled or uneasy. This made me more puzzled and uneasy. And what I found was, in then, that there were so many simple explanatory models. The schizophrenogenic mother, that all schizophrenia was caused by mothers. Fathers weren't even brought into it. That really worried me, these all-embracive, universal explanations. The psychiatrists that I started with, they were a mix of good souls and zealots. And I found that many addressed their insecurity by intellectual incest. They had a great need to form a sect. And that really worried me. And so for the college exam, we should see one patient for 50 sessions under supervision by one psychiatrist. I actually chose three patients and three supervisors because I actually wanted to avoid or avert the risk of intellectual incest, and also wanted to have the opportunity to test differing models. But I found the field immensely attractive. It pressed the same buttons that I'd had as an adolescent in terms of social injustice in particular. I wasn't a highbrow reader in adolescence. Steinbeck pressed my buttons. But I certainly remember my second week where I came across a man who was a paraplegic, and he hadn't been able to walk for 2 years. He lived in a country town in a car, and he had an 18-year-old girlfriend, and they were in love. And I just thought it was the most wonderful story. Again, I would hope that I was not merely being voyeuristic. I was just struck by stories of human resilience right from the very beginning, and I think psychiatry is redolent with those stories. In terms of my psychiatric career, well, I've been at the University of New South Wales for nearly half a century. I'm still at Prince of Wales. I did run the hospital service for 15 years before I got smart, and was executive director at the Black Dog Institute, that was the most privileged position, the opportunity to start something new and bring together an operative model involving clinical work, research work, community activities, and others was a great thrill. But I decided late last year and gave the board 18 months that 10 years in the job, about to hit 70, they were nice round numbers, time to step on. And I now have gone back to my day job, which is University of New South Wales research and clinician. So I enjoy clinical work a lot. As a researcher, I like looking at the models and trying to work out what are the important ones and where the model may be flawed and where it might be improved, and the treatment implications of that. And let me just give a few quotes about the attraction for research. Somebody said, science, like sex, has a function, but it's not why we do it. And in reality, I think what scientists are after is, as said here by Hinshelwood, is the adventure of discovery itself. Seek simplicity and distrust it. Samuel Johnson, curiosity can be the first passion and the last. And I still am passionate about research. So I can't really think of many days apart from when I'm not on holidays, when I'm actually not working away at a research idea. And that's the passion as well as the clinical side. And I think the two can come together. And for me, I've been lucky in many ways that they have. So what did I bring to psychiatry? In terms of content, I've really focused on the mood disorders. Barney Carroll, an ex-Australian psychiatrist now in the States, said that if you can understand depression, then you can understand psychiatry, because there are so many differing models for the depressive disorders. I've also brought a contrarian personality style, and I'll talk about that. And this pattern analytic approach of trying to intuitively look at issues, but not merely operate by intuition itself. And I'll talk about the attractors of psychiatry. So here's the quote by Barney Carroll: to understand depression is to understand psychiatry. What I've tried to do in the last 20 years has to really make sense of the quagmire that's around in regard to depression and how to treat it. So the second part of the book, there's about 80 pages, which is condensed down from a couple of hundred pages, dealing with really difficult issues, such as how do we model depression, do antidepressants work. That's the heartland, and it's the thing I feel most passionate about, and I'll try to explain why. So the crisis in psychiatry, Louis Menand wrote in The New Yorker, although other areas of medicine continue to make genuine advances, psychiatry is founding in an ivory tower-spun web of diagnoses that jumble differing diseases together. The psychiatric literature is so confusing that even the dissidents disagree. And this dissident agrees. Everything from the science, i.e. do the medications actually work, to the metaphysics, i.e. is depression really a disease, will confuse you. As a branch of medicine, depression seems to be a mess. Next one, thanks. Gary Greenberg, a psychologist who wrote this wonderful book, Manufacturing Depression, said the antidepressant business looks like a demolition derby. A collision of negative research results, questionable research and regulatory practices, and popular disenchantment with the whole pharmacological regime. Look at the next one. Horwitz and Wakefield, who've written a book called The Loss of Sadness, and they argue that psychiatry has continued increasingly to pathologize normal states, normative states, particularly those of human mood disorders, grief, and so on and so forth. And in fact, I won't go into their opening. But and then they accuse psychiatrists of then advancing and pathologizing conditions, and then applying psychopharmacology in a way that beggars relevance. And so then the issue of cosmetic psychopharmacology is raised. That is probably the most articulate book in terms of how psychiatry imperialism has increasingly moved the bar from clinical disease state through disorders down to normative states that are worrying so much of the population. But let me give you a flavour of the concern. So you can see these are leading weeklies, Newsweek and Independent, that have come out. Books all expressing grave concern about the shifting bars in diagnoses and whether differing pharmacological treatments work. This book, Anatomy of an Epidemic, by Whitaker. Is a powerful polemic. Next one, Manufacturing Depression by Gary Greenberg, a beautiful book, really raising serious questions. So let me now try to cover what I think have been the concerns. Depression can, in my view, it's a meaningless word. It's rather like just saying breathlessness. Depression can be clinical, and where we can have disease-like states, which we call melancholia and bipolar depression. And, of course, you can have non-disease states, we're sort of heterogeneous group of non-melancholic clinical disorders. And, of course, you can have normal depression. It is normal for all of us to get depressed. What happened was in 1980, DSM-3 came into place, tried to knock the analysts out of the ring, and came up with a very simple model of depression. It threw away 2,000 years of depression classification that said there are diseases and there are reactions, the old binary model. And it said, we'll disregard depression as a single condition varying by severity. As simple as that. And they came up with major depression, which sounds really important, but the way in which they defined it is like a psychological sneeze. And then they had a whole group of minor depressions. And the optics of DSM-3 were major depression would be for the psychiatrist, and everyone should get medication, and the minor depressions would be for the analysts. And that was known by a few of my colleagues as the neurotic peace treaty. And ICD did the same thing. It dimensionalised depression as severe, moderate and mild. Next one, please. Now, the predictable problem then emerged. Up to the 1950s, your lifetime chance of clinical depression was probably 5 to 10%. But if you've now dimensionalised clinical depression, you've got major and minor, and progressively they moved it down into what categories called subsyndromal and subclinical depression. And now in DSM-5, they're proposing a category called mixed anxiety depression. You know, you just need two little piddly symptoms. Mixed anxiety depression, the acronym is MAD. And basically, when you look at these criteria for clinical depression, then lifetime risk is going to be 100%. Because there's been psychiatric imperialism, and that worries me immensely. And that then helps to explain where antidepressants that are, to my mind, the first line of treatment for the disease-like states, and often helpful for a number of others. But if you move into normative states, they lose their boundary. Who gets into the clinical trials of antidepressants? Basically, people who are volunteers in the community in the United States who get paid $10,000, who have spontaneously improving conditions and who do not have substantive clinical conditions. So when you look at the trials comparing antidepressant drugs to placebo, you don't get separation. And basically then there is the big problem that becomes the evidence base. But the apples of the clinical trials do not extrapolate to the oranges of the clinical world. And so evidence-based psychiatry risks being an oxymoron, in my view. So the DSM problem has created a number of issues. Antidepressants do not look particularly effective. Because of that, many people then say, well, antidepressants are merely placebos or act like placebos. And that has many major consequences for people who benefit immensely. And clinical depression has now been pathologized. And the real concerns is melancholia, the quintessential disease state, for which medication is way ahead of all other treatment modalities, is very, very effective, although not all antidepressants are equal. The SSRIs are remarkably unhelpful for melancholia, but do you ever read about that? Pharmaceutical companies say all antidepressants are equal. They're not. They range in their spectrum, rather like antibiotics. But melancholia we can treat with high levels of success, but it does not respond to cognitive behaviour therapy or counselling or psychoanalysis, whatever. But, unfortunately, all the evidence base around these days in the last 30 years is in regard to major depression, where all treatments look equal. And the consequences of that are dreadful. Next one, please. So melancholia has been marginalised, and the treatment that people get in this city, as in other parts of Australia and America, is more shaped by the background discipline or training of the practitioner than anything else, which is a Procrustean model. So if you turn up with depression type X and see a doctor, you'll get an antidepressant drug. Same type of depression, a psychologist, you get cognitive behavior therapy. Same type of depression, you see a lady wearing a caftan, you'll get crystal therapy. Now, I know of no other model in medicine where the patient is fitted to the background training of the practitioner, rather than in the rest of medicine, where the model is, what is the cause and what can we do to redress the cause? Be the cause biological, be it social or psychological. And that's the issue in regard to the mood disorders. There are differing ones reflecting biological, social and so on. And Ned Shorter, a great historian, criticises the DSM. Major depression, he says, was essentially a political artefact born of academic infighting. This is not supposed to happen. Again, he said, to broadly define major depression was to make it virtually a market basket. Major depression served the then nascent field of biological psychiatry in the way that psychoneurosis once served psychoneurosis served psychoanalysis. And as Shorter said, the big problem is this universal treatment where practitioners have one modality and they apply it everywhere. The aphorism being, if all you have is a hammer, then everything looks like a nail. Now, would that happen if you had major breathlessness, if you saw your doctor with major breathlessness? He said, you've got major breathlessness. You'd say, I think this man's a fool. I want to know whether I've got asthma or pneumonia or pulmonary embolus, because you would then expect you get a bronchodilator, an antibiotic or an anticoagulant as relevant. That's what we need for the mood disorders, rather than the simplistic view that depression is a single condition varying by severity. Next one, thanks. So DSM was and continues to be a political document, and if you've been following the debates about DSM-5, the scene is hotting up even more than I've captured here, where grief was pathologised, where they're talking about an attenuated psychosis syndrome. That means you're not psychotic, but you may turn out to be psychotic, and therefore we should give you an antipsychotic drug. Talking about... basically being a bit bolshy in childhood and that being some sort of expression of bipolar disorder. So the whole concept of psychiatric imperialism, of moving the threshold for disorders down, 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 and then the opportunistic, and I wouldn't be critical of the pharmaceutical companies, that's their game, but then the opportunistic take-up of these lower set defined conditions has tremendous implications. And in fact, it's only in the last week that under fierce criticism, including a petition signed by 18,000 people, DSM-5 has retracted from pathologizing grief and retracted from the attenuated psychosis syndrome. So that is the first change in the 5 years of this latest process. So psychiatry's most recent crisis is one of expansionism, going beyond the boundaries and pathologizing many states. And that concerns me. Next one, thanks. And Gary Greenberg said, pathologizing normal experience. When doctors turn suffering into symptoms, symptoms into diseases, and diseases into a condition to be cured, they're acting not as scientists, but as moral philosophers. Next one. Nevertheless, there are some advantages to this whole process. In expanding the boundaries, I think depression has become democratized. It's less them versus us. It's more we're all in this together. And I think that's a tremendous advantage. People feel less stigmatized. In Australia, we are way ahead of every other country in the world. And that's been led by so many politicians and sportsmen talking openly. And that has just been wonderful. So there has been an advantage. And then at one level, what Gary Greenberg says, it all doesn't matter. And that worries me at one level. But listen to his words. I think they're beautiful. Call your sorrow a disease or don't. Take drugs or don't. See a therapist or don't. But whatever you do, when life drives you to your knees, which it's bound to do, which maybe it's meant to do, don't settle for being sick in the brain. So seek help. What I would argue for, we need to make sure when we encourage people to get to help that they get sophisticated help. So my 20-year campaign as a psychiatrist has been to critique, particularly to define melancholia and its causes and demonstrate differing treatment responses, to try to identify other meaningful depressive disorders, particularly the bipolar 2 condition, which is increasingly being recognised as a substantive and differing condition and needing differing approaches. Improving the definition and measurement of these conditions and clarifying the therapies. Next one. And what worries me is we've had the decade of the brain. We've got wonderfully well-trained, really bright scientists all around the world, particularly in the United States. But if the paradigms, the models are wrong, that invokes the Bavarian proverb, what's the use of running if you're on the wrong road? And so I'm in there and I'm sort of out there and getting into it. Now, the problem with that is it invokes Ginsberg's theorem, which is, for me, you can't win, you can't even break even, and you can't even quit the game. And my personal problems, which I articulate again in the book, is there are problems with being Mr. Blunt and being a contrarian. In defence of being a contrarian, I would argue that science is not consensual. And that's the problem. We get so many consensual statements, but science isn't. Secondly, to invoke Ricky Gervais, if you're not offending someone, you're not doing anything. And then to also invoke the local lad, Alan Kohler, collegiality is too highly valued. Every board should contain a prickly bastard who keeps asking questions and won't shut up. Now, the problem if you're a contrarian is that you get a binary response of either ropeable anger or to the Totschweig tactic reaction. Next one. So this is the ropeable anger response as applied to me. Next one is this very interesting death by silence, Totschweig tactic response. And as Shelley Gehr articulated, it's a simple ignoring strategy of depriving people by cutting off their oxygen. It's very effective for killing off creative ideas or contrary opinions. The genius of the Tosh is it's difficult to prove a negative. Recipients often sound plaintive, rather like the kid that didn't get invited to the birthday party. But it's often a staging post to unwelcome ideas. And she says, first they ignore you, then they mock you, then they attack you viciously. Finally they say, oh, we knew that all along. Now, does the end justify the means? And that's seemed to me important to look at. If I've been a contrarian, is that really utilitarianly wise? So the question I raise, are people more successful if they're less abrasive and provocative and more collegiate? Are achievements more likely to be realised and sustained by a collegial, non-contrarian approach? I would put it up for contemplation. Now, the next issue that I look at the book is to look at this issue of pattern analysis or clinical reasoning. And I appreciate you can't read it, but what I really would like to argue is that I see psychiatry and many aspects of medicine, good medicine, being an iteration between the evidence base, the hard facts, and observational analyses and common sense, which, as somebody said, is remarkably uncommon. So I would argue that we need ideographic pattern analysis. We need, you know, I want to be able to be making a hypothesis when somebody walks into my office, whether there's a loss of light in their eyes, as to whether they're moving their arms and with fluidity, whether their voice is monotonous, and so on. All of those things are going into my brain as a computer. And they're being sort of pulled together in a Bayesian-type way of all these facts coming together to be assembled in a sort of probabilistic manner. This is the most likely diagnosis. This person is most likely to respond to this treatment. And the tragedy of this is that it takes decades to acquire these skills, even if you have the propensity for it, as against many medical practitioners, psychiatrists who more engage in, you know, sort of painting by numbers. You just learn DSM criteria lists and that's psychiatry. So the tragedy, it takes a long period of time. But the other point that I go into is that as you do this more and more, it actually changes your brain. And so the issue of neuroplasticity, which I think has become increasingly recognised, Norman Doidge writing about it, and this, where I've got this quote, even thoughts can change the structure and function of the brain. And Schwartz saying, the experience of our lives leave footprints in the sands of our brain. And I've personally experienced neuroplasticity at a number of times. And I remember when I went from a daydreaming adolescent into being a young junior doctor, my brain so abruptly changed. Actually, you remarked on it when I was sailing with a few friends on a skiff across Sydney Harbour. I said, my brain changed last week. And they changed the topic because it was a bit abrupt. We're about to hit a Manly ferry. And as an editor, I can move into convergent mode, and then when I'm working as a creative writer or whatever, I can move into divergent mode. The point I would make is that as a clinician, I think every clinical experience has the capacity to change your brain if you have that predisposition and improve your clinical skills. And that is really important. Wonderful book. I know we're running out of time, so I won't go into details, but Catherine Montgomery, a journalist, wrote this book called How Doctors Think. And she said, if medicine was a science, a well-programmed computer would substitute for the best physician. Medicine relies on phrenesis, Aristotle's term for practical reasoning. Its success lies on the physician's capacity for clinical judgment. It's neither a science nor a technical skill, or that combines both. A physician's diagnosis is a plot summary. Decisions are not just based on the evidence, but by developing working hypotheses. It's not celebrated, and it needs to be. And the problem is we don't know as educators whether we can teach it. Thank you. Cover this last section quickly, the attractions of being a psychiatrist. One is the breadth of the clinical brain, the clinical domain. And secondly, again, to go back to Montgomery, it's important, to my mind, to be able to give people a diagnosis. To know the cause of disease is to have control. Montgomery again, patients want to know what's wrong, if it's serious, how long it will last, whether it will alter their plans. Just having a diagnosis means the rest of your life can start. I believe that our patients need to get a diagnosis. Every week I see somebody who's been seeing a therapist for 5, 10, 15 years, and I say, okay, what's the game plan? And they'll say, oh, we haven't got round to that yet. The privilege of being a psychiatrist. When a patient tells you this story, you are a privileged guest in their life. And you observe the richness of people. I'll say to somebody whose wife's left them, they've just gone bankrupt, and they've had all sorts of adversity, and I'll just say, it was a bit of a rough week, doc. And I just think, how could you? And so the concept of seeing these everyday heroes, I think, is been one of the real privileges. Louis Brissagler said, too often we underestimate the power of a touch, a smile, a kind word, a listening ear, an honest compliment, or the smallest act of caring, all of which have the potential to turn a life around. And I think this, obviously we expect our doctors to be empathic, but I think in psychiatry it is central, it's front of house, but it shouldn't be the whole story. You're not just listening or trying to interpret a narrative, you need to make a diagnosis. And Les Murray touched on this wonderful Australian style. He said, the ability to laugh at venerated things and at awesome things may in time prove to be one of Australia's greatest gifts to mankind. When I entered psychiatry, I think our capacity to help people was fairly limited. I think now with mood disorders we can help about 80% of people. And I think that's a fantastic statistic, and we should walk proud as long as we get the right model and we have more rational modes of treatment. And from my personal viewpoint, this is something I wrote in a Black Dog report a few years ago. The attraction of psychiatry to me, the end of the day, is to see the light return to someone's eyes, to hear that they can see colour in their world. People with depression lose the capacity to see colour again, and to hear their expressions of hope is the best return on any clinical investment. So why, in concluding, if my past oblivious is now past obvious, what are the implications for other people? And that's the final step of the book that I wanted to get into. As I said, as an adolescent, I had no insight about my future career. I could not identify my strengths. I think I lacked the intellectual strengths that might have predicted a career in medicine, and I was unaware of my key ones, the ones that turned out to work for me: implicit learning, pattern analysis, creativity. And psychiatry provided the fit, but that only looks, or only comes together retrospectively. Next slide. So Billy Connolly, I think, nailed it in terms of how we can sort of extrapolate this experience to our adolescent kids and grandkids. And he said in a book called Wisdom, essentially say to your child, try to do something that you feel drawn to. It's not like a job. It's your raison d'etre. It's the reason to wake. In essence, pursue what you feel passionate about. And that, I think, is absolutely wonderful. And I think for those who are privileged enough to have the opportunity, because many people around the world have no choice about their career, but if we have the opportunity to pursue our passion, seems to be the central message. And then, after that, I think Marty Seligman's hierarchy becomes applicable. A job is better than no job. A career is better than a job. And a calling is better than a career. So that we should be aspirational over our working years and take it up. Final one. The tone of the book, I really tried to mix it up, as you might have imagined. The first 80 personal pages are sort of Clive James-ish derivative. The second is incredibly serious. It's to my mind, the most important aspect of the book, but it risks being seen as overly complicated and turgid. It is all about what concerns me about diagnosis and management of mood disorders. And the final one is to try to see what I have learned about career choice by examining my own career. And the final one I've got here is I would also want to defend my status as a quotophiliac by in turn quoting Montaigne, who said, I quote others to better express myself. Thank you very much.
Many thanks. Janet Grundy's got some copies of A Piece of My Mind, A Psychiatrist on the Couch, and I'm sure that Professor Parker would be happy to sign them after. So we've got a bit over 20 minutes for questions and discussion. Just starting off, you present yourself as a bit of a contrarian, but then your Undine moment, I mean, you're on the beach and your future wife is 400 metres down the way and you can link up. I mean, Anne and I met selling school books in a bookshop. It seems very romantic. And then your time at UNSW at the Prince of Wales and Prince Henry Hospitals and the Black Dog Institute as an editor and as a writer was part of a writing team. I mean, you seem to be able to get on with people. So how contrary is that? You seem to have good personal relationships. So maybe I'm reading you wrongly.
I think that might provoke me into saying I'm an absolute prick. I've always been Mr. Blunt, and I don't think I modify that at all. But I am certainly collegiate a lot of the time, and I've been blessed by a rich family life, and I appreciate that very much. But when I hear cant, or when I hear foolishness amongst my professional colleagues, I cannot hold myself back. I'm getting a little better as I get older, but I haven't really improved a lot. And the problem is, as the Bible said, if you kick against the pricks will kick back. So I think I reserve it largely within the profession, because that's where it presses my buttons. Because, first of all, I am concerned about the falsity of the logic or the mythology. But secondly, I am really concerned about the implications downstream, where people get the wrong diagnosis and the wrong management. And that's where I really go very strongly into bat. Now, if you won't mind, I'll just tell one vignette. I would like to talk about Charmaine Dragoon, because that is a public scenario. And Charmaine Dragoon was a Channel 10 newsreader who killed herself. And she had developed depression as an adolescent, and she'd been treated in Perth, and then she came to Sydney. She had a number of psychiatrists, and she also had a psychologist, and she was given a diagnosis of non-specific depression over the years. And a lot of the time in Sydney, she was walking through the national parks with the psychologist and being encouraged to meditate and so on and so forth. But in fact, she had a absolutely clear-cut bipolar 2 disorder. If you read, as I did for the coronial inquiry, if you read her diaries, if you looked at her own comments to family members, if you looked at her mother, Estelle Dragoon's queries to her, if you talked to her work colleagues and her friends, they all described severe highs and severe lows. She had a bipolar 2 disorder. It was a 72 or 73-year-old general practitioner of the Western suburbs who said, I don't think this is a depressive condition. I'm suspicious of bipolar disorder, and referred her on. Unfortunately, Charmaine did not get to that review and ended up killing herself at the Gap. Now, these days, bipolar 2 disorder is an eminently treatable condition, but you do not treat it with antidepressants, by and large. In fact, that can make it worse. So Charmaine Dragoon was a very, I think, it was a way of respecting her life to actually go in with the permission of her parents to talk about this as a vignette of when the diagnosis is imprecise and where the consequences, in her case, were fatal. And that's what presses my button.
Just stay there. Stay here now.
Sure.
But just very briefly, how do you treat bipolar 2?
I don't want this to sound like an advertisement, but we actually are very impressed with a drug called lamotrigine, and we've recently looked at a study of 100 consecutive people that we gave a diagnosis of bipolar 2 for the first time, and we followed them up 12 weeks later, and the whole group improved basically like that. But in the multivariate analysis, which looked at all the predictors of improvement, those who put on lamotrigine had a 5 times greater chance of improving, which has gone with the clinical signals that we've been observing as this drug has come into psychiatry in the last few years. But in addition to medication, which puts in the flooring boards for this mood disorder, we also argue very strongly for education, well-being plans and monitoring. So we see it as a pluralistic model, but not for the standard ways in which you would treat depression, because antidepressants can, in fact, move people into very nasty, worrying mixed states, rapid cycling, and increase the suicidal predisposition.
Lindsay, Gordon, just stay here. And
yes,
just
sure.
Talking down the back. Yeah.
For a long time, the coroners and the police would never publicise a death as a suicide because it had all antisocial consequences. Now the trend seems to be the other way. Is the public's greater knowledge of suicide helping remedy the problem amongst those more vulnerable?
Yes and no. You have to be very careful in the media coverage, and therefore there are guidelines that the media should not report suicide in ways that encourage any copycat phenomenon. So if you have the evocative death of some young rock star, then the way in which that's reported has to be absolutely scrupulously, you know, sanitised to prevent any copycat risk. But I think if it is examined to try to work out the meaning behind it and what we can learn from it, then in fact there is an argument. An Australian story in mid-June will be reporting on the suicide of Dana Bliss, Alan Bond's wife. And that, I think, will be an extremely important examination of and be the positive aspects of looking at suicide. I'd like to take the opportunity, although it's not really part of your question, in the media we talk or hear a lot about suicide. We hear about high rates and increasing rates, particularly in young men. I need to report to you that in the last 6 years, suicide rates in Australia have decreased for men and women and in every age group. And the biggest group where suicide rates have gone down are young men aged 18 to 30, where they have dropped from 40 per 100,000 to 18 per 100,000. They have more than halved. That's wonderful, and we don't know why, but my suspicion is destigmatisation. The more people that are prepared to get help for their mood disorder, and the more people that get to help and the more people that get appropriate help, we then avert or lower the risk of suicide. So I think, in coming back to your question, if the suicide coverage leads to that destigmatisation, then I think there can be advantages.
Right down the back, yes. Yep.
Wondering, sounds like you're having to go into battle with your peers quite often. What sort of impact do you think you're having in how they're thinking about diagnosis? Like, are you flipping out the implicit or having people think like you do?
The question is, to what kind of impact do you think you're having on your peers?
It's only become, I think, reasonably encouraging in the last 3 or 4 years. Firstly, for melancholia, which, as I earlier mentioned, we regard as a disease state and with prioritised drug treatment. That's not that you just use drugs only. We actually put a submission into DSM-5. It was published in the American Journal of Psychiatry, and I was the first author, but for the first time I had North American co-authors, and we had people from the UK and from Greece and other places in the world. And so I think we've now got a contrary view. So there is now a debate rather than universal acceptance of DSM. So I think we're starting to pull ahead with melancholia. And certainly I get asked to talk about melancholia all around the world. And, you know, many of the places I go to, you know, Russia, South America, they say it's just wonderful to, because there's nothing new about melancholia. All I'm doing is a paradigm lost, you know, being regained. So I think that one is pulling ahead. Bipolar 2, I edited the first book ever published on bipolar 2 disorder, and that I think has attracted a lot of international interest. In fact, it's the fastest book to have a second edition by Cambridge University Press. And I think that we're gradually moving many of the people in this country from having the view that bipolar 2 disorder doesn't exist at all, to being a rare disorder, to actually starting to assess. Just to finish up on that question, you know, the ubiquitous or at least the high rate of bipolar 2 disorder. There's a recent book out by Jonathan Davison called Number 10 Downing Street, where he looks at the mood disorders amongst British prime ministers, and 16% of the first 51 prime ministers had a bipolar disorder. Not just Winston Churchill, bipolar 2. And Davidson concludes that Britain did better out of its bipolar prime ministers than it did out of its self-doubting, anxious ones. Not one lost office as a consequence of it, and in fact there were many gains. So that in fact, I think that we need to avoid romanticising bipolar like Stephen Fry. You know, Stephen Fry says, to get on Hollywood these days, you no longer have to be Jewish or gay, but my God, you've got to have bipolar. But Stephen Fry retracted in BBC TV last year about June. He said, one day this condition is going to kill me. So this is, and it has the highest suicide rate of all conditions in psychiatry, bipolar 2 disorder. So I think we're making a step forward with melancholia and bipolar 2, and they are big ticket items, but still minority views.
There's a question here, then we go right down the back, yeah?
Would you be prepared to say where in Sydney you can get the treatment you advocate?
Well, the Black Dog Institute runs a clinic and it operates to that model. And it's a free service, I'm immensely proud of it. Yep.
Right down the back, it's Richard, is it? Yeah.
With a focus on decriminalising illegal drugs and illegal drugs' impact on depression, what's your view on what we should do as a society?
Look, I think that's a whole separate debate where I'm really not competent in offering a view. I have my personal view, but there are caveats to it. I think it would take too long to go into it. We certainly do see more mood disorders, obviously, as a consequence of illicit drug taking and also licit drug taking. I mean, one of the possible explanations for the increase in bipolar 2 disorder is the greater use of ecstasy and other illicit stimulants, but also the higher intakes of coffee. So it's a very complicated story. Yep.
There's a question down here.
Good evening, Professor. You spoke largely about depression. Do you sort of blanket in with it what's commonly called anxiety disorders?
No, although...
The question is there a link between depression and anxiety disorders?
Unfortunately, many psychiatrists do regard them as synonymous. They basically say, and the reality is that most people get depressed will get a level of anxiety. Most people with anxiety, when it gets severe, will get depressed. But I distinguish the two of them and do so phenomenologically, meaning by definition. Depression to me is to feel depressed and have a drop in your self-esteem or self-worth. Depression is a state of feeling fearful, insecure, phenomenologically distinct. And so as a psychiatrist, I'm often trying to work out what's primary here. Is it anxiety leading to depression or depression leading to anxiety? And then I go in to treat the first, with the model being that if I take care of the primary condition, then the secondary consequences should be handled. So I do believe it's extremely important to work out which is the primary one, anxiety or depression.
Anne, yep.
How much, I don't want to use the word damage, but how much disadvantage to people's success at finding a solution to their depressive disorders has the debate been between those who are very emotionally opposed to any kind of drug use? I mean, we've had figures here, or at least one figure that's spoken, and it seemed to be a very emotive decision. I mean, if it was cancer or something,
yes,
it wouldn't be this
no medication kind of argument.
So what's behind that, and how much
does
it help people back finding a successful answer to their troubles?
Well, the opposition to drugs, I think, comes about for a number of reasons. One is general stigma about psychiatry, concerns about psychiatry. I think the film that did psychiatry the greatest damage was One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest in regard to ECT and medication. And that was an easy opportunity for people to be polarised and to see the abuses. And there were no doubt there were great abuses that occurred in psychiatry with psychosurgery, which I have to say in parenthesis, can be appropriate for a very small percentage of people. It's just coming back. It's called deep brain stimulation. There's only about 60 people in the world that have had it, but the results from melancholic depression, terminal people not responding to anything else, very successful. The same type of surgery has been given to about 30,000 people with Parkinson's disease. The point I make is, if it's psychiatry, people go, oh, danger, because psychiatry has let many people down. And then the other aspect I get, I guess, is the zealots and the people who apply the same model to everything. So whoever walks in, and particularly the concern I have about many general practitioners, and I have to say, unfortunately, largely male. Somebody walks into a general practice surgery, they say depression, and within 2 minutes, the GP's eyes have dropped and they're writing a prescription for an antidepressant. They're no longer being a human being. We did a survey looking at referral notes to the Black Dog Institute. The average male GP wrote 20 words, the average female, 120 words. We did a survey of how long GPs spend with depressed people. The average male was about 6 minutes. The average female GP was 40 minutes. So I think if you rush to pharmacology and you don't learn about the person and their narrative, their story, then you ramp up the risk of people just seeing the worst aspects of psychopharmacology. My model is a bit like the management of diabetes. There's type 1 diabetes where you probably would prioritise insulin, and there's type 2 diabetes where you'd probably prioritise life changes, losing weight, exercise, and so on. So I'm a horses for courses man. Basically, is it a biological depression where we'll prioritise medication but not at the expense of other components, or is it due to the way in which they see the world, we'll prioritise trying to reset their personality style, or is it all due to huge life events and we'll try to neutralise the life events or help them to deal with them? Again, go back to what is the cause and what can you do to hit that cause? And that's where you need the science to inform you, but you need common sense. And DSM and other models where everything is rolled into some sort of universal Procrustean model has set back, to my mind, psychiatry over the last 30 years, really more than any other area in medicine and probably in psychiatry. Depression is the worst of the lot.
Look, we have other questions here, but we're right on 7 o'clock and I think that's a very appropriate place to finish. As I said, Joanna Grundy's got copies of A Piece of My Mind, A Psychiatrist on the Couch, and I'm sure Gordon Park would be happy to sign copies. I'll be very brief. I mean, as you will have witnessed, Gordon Parker is a brilliant communicator. And he's also a very compassionate and highly regarded doctor. And he's written a very witty and challenging memoir, A Piece of My Mind, A Psychiatrist on the Couch. He's done immensely important work in Australia and internationally, but partly at the Black Dog Institute and elsewhere. We're delighted that he spoke to us tonight about his book. He's been here before, he's been here tonight, no doubt we'll have him back again, but for tonight, Gordon Parker, well done and congratulations.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.